You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 29th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On today's program, Ari Paul, independent progressive journalist, on the wave of far-right parties winning in European elections, European parliamentary elections in Europe last week. What does that say about austerity? What does that say about Islamophobia, anti-Semitism? What are the differences inside the far-right? And is there an opportunity for a genuine left? We're going to get to all of that with Ari Paul. Also, Mitch McConnell attempting a magical move where he disconnects the success of the healthcare exchanges in Kentucky with the national law that allows them to be possible. It's pretty amazing. Many other stories. We'll get to this more tomorrow, but it's important to mention that the U.S. economy has contracted for the first time in 3 years. We'll get to that more tomorrow. Obviously, bad news.
We're not even finished promoting today's show, and you're already.
I need it. Well, that's a banner news, man. All right,
we're also
we be
bringing you a little bit from
the economy's imploding. All right, some right wing guy said something stupid.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's very true. Also, we will be bringing you a little bit of we'll be talking about the Snowden interview that NBC aired last night. Some interesting things from there, and what I found more interesting was the response to it from John Kerry. Also, we'll be looking at a certain libertarian we like to, poke holes in, I guess, his ideology on this show. But we've come across something that's a little bit more disturbing than usual.
Yeah, it's really creepy.
Yeah. But that and more. But first, we're going to be bringing you a story.
So, yeah, our old buddy, Frank Luntz, who the last time we talked to you about Frank Luntz, he was suffering a severe depression.
Well, he was sad that the newsroom was only being renewed for another season. He was just really pissed that people don't seem to share his worldview anymore.
Yeah, people all of a sudden in his focus groups,
really
people
weird.
Don't want to decimate Social Security. People don't want to listen to the wise words of various corporate head honchos that he pulls for. And he's trying to break into Hollywood but couldn't quite make it. And the Coke Zeros and the Spaghetti Bolognese in his multi-million dollar Beverly Hills home.
He had like movie marathons in his man cave.
Yes. In his
while
mansion.
Eating SpaghettiOs and, oh man.
Spaghetti Bolognese.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It just wasn't cutting.
I would eat SpaghettiOs.
You have a more populist cred than Frank Luntz. But we have new news from Frank Luntz. So Frank Luntz was on
You can't say Frank Luntz without going into Sam's intro for him. The ethically and follically challenged Frank Luntz.
We should also add the emotionally challenged as well.
To be fair. Yes.
Frank Luntz was on a Nevada local television station talking about Harry Reid.
It's a pretty popular show, too.
Very popular show.
It's like their big local show. What's it called?
John Ralston.
The Ralston Report. Yes.
Very popular local political show. Ralston's kind of like a, you know, an impresario of Nevada politics. And Luntz is on there to badmouth Reed. But he takes this bizarre turn where all of a sudden, because Harry Reid has been vocal about the Washington Redskins, they should change their name because, I mean.
And not just Harry Reid, though. I believe, what, 49 other
senators
signed this petition. How many people do we have in the Senate again?
We have 100.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
But Harry Reid is on the completely obvious, this name is obviously racist and offensive and should be changed bandwagon. And Frank Luntz lays into an attack on him out of nowhere. He bursts into it. He goes, this is Luntz, quote, he's spending his time trying to get the Washington Redskins, which the last time I checked them on map is 2,000 miles away from Nevada, and he wants to change the Redskins' name, and he hasn't done it, if you use my language, crap, for veterans on Memorial Day. So clearly, Luntz is moving from depression to anger, which is good on an emotional scale, but what he still always is through it all is emphasis on the ethically challenged, and Matt's going to tell you why. What is something about the Redskins that Luntz didn't mention?
Now, you see, in order to defend the Redskins' name, the owners of the Redskins have decided they need to, you know, speak with consultants, you know, pros, media trained professionals, as you will. And who better to defend the Redskins' name than the same people who are hired as consultants by the Republican Party? And who are one of those people that the Redskins pay to consult them on defending the name? The Redskins? Why? It's Frank Luntz!
So he, in a totally non sequitur way, brings up this issue in a completely random and incoherent fashion and then does not disclose that he's on retainer and has been paid by the Redskins. So Frank Luntz, just never stop being you. We'll be right back. We're going to take a brief break. I think we'll play a little Clash to fight the fascists in Europe, and then we're going to come back with Ari Paul.
I wanted to play Nazi punks F off, but I don't think there's, the language.
Yeah, too many.
It's too early. We're not in the better half yet.
We're not in the better half. All right, we'll be right back, folks. Welcome back. This is the Majority Report. That was very fittingly the Clash because of what we're about to talk about. And joining us now is Ari Paul. He's an independent political journalist and, full disclosure, a friend and sometime writing partner of myself. Ari, thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure. So Ari, and we should mention Ari as a genuine, rugged and grassroots journalist is talking to us from the stairwell of his workplace. So this is very this is a people power moment. I wanted to talk with you obviously about the elections that happened for the European Parliament in Europe this past week. The far right did incredibly well. That's the kind of banner takeaway. But I think there's a lot to disaggregate here in terms of what led to their success. I think that clearly, you know, these are real political impulses in Europe, and that can't be ignored. At the same time, The success can't be separated from austerity. The other thing that's probably important to really get into as well is that this is not a monolithic block of parties, and they actually represent different strains of the far right. But let's start by the kind of broad takeaway for you as an observer of what's the kind of core reason that you see for these results, which, you know, and you can get into some of the examples of some who some of these parties are, how well they actually did, and the specifics are, in many cases, I mean, they're really much more shocking than just the kind of generic takeaway of, oh, far-right parties did good, because some of these parties are, you know, it's truly astounding that they're performing well in 2014.
Right, right. There was a very interesting sort of graphic in the Financial Times a day or two after the election that lumped the Greek left-wing party Syriza in the same category as the right-wing National Front in France and the UK Independence Party in the United Kingdom as quote-unquote populist parties separated from, you know, what they considered the more mainstream, acceptable, either, you know, established social democratic parties or center-right parties that were sort of dutifully executing the austerity measures that that Brussels and the European Central Bank have generally outlined. And at first you sort of look at this and you think, well, this is just patently absurd. How could you put, you know, Syriza, which is a political organization that essentially wants a government that works for all people regardless of nationality or religion or race, in the same category as, you know, political parties that genuinely are mourning the fall of the Third Reich and have an affinity for the darkest moments in all of Europe. Right. But once you get past that, what you do realize is that there is a certain kind of fundamental truth here, which is that the reason we're at this stage is that there is genuine anger all over Europe, not just in the quote-unquote pig countries, the countries that are in the debt crisis, but, you know, in France and the United Kingdom and Germany even, the people are suffering from high unemployment, services being slashed, all sorts of things like that. And so there's a lot of genuine anger that a political party can easily tap into. And I think where you see the right ascending are places where there is either not a visible left alternative or where the left has come into some sort of power and thus they are who are to be rebelled against. I mean, right. France is a pretty good example of that, where the Socialist Party is in power. And I think, I can't remember who put it, but you have a French socialist president who is better known by his affairs than by his actual policies. So it's very easy for the right to swoop in when the left is associated with all of these problems that austerity is handing down.
Right.
That's
a really, and we'll get back to Syriza because that's kind of like the most, you know, that's if you're looking for some positive news to glean, they did very well and that's some positive news to glean. But I think, so that's a really important point. So if we're saying fundamentally this is about, this is in some reaction to austerity, and then the response to policies like austerity, they can kind of be a kick down or kick up populism, essentially. So you can respond to austerity with, the social safety net's being decimated, the economy's terrible, the financial sector's endlessly getting placated. So therefore, I'm going to focus on kind of like changes I don't like in my immediate environment. I hate immigrants. It's their fault. Or I can get after them. Well, let's actually have a real political agenda that reverses austerity and holds people accountable. So, I mean, I guess is the main argument that you would make that any time we see these forces in the far right, and soon we'll start to disaggregate them a little bit, but any time we see these forces, is that fair to say that that is a failure of the left? Is that the main takeaway? That any time these grow, it's the left's failure to seriously fight an anti-austerity measures, essentially?
I think it definitely contributes. Yeah. I mean, because it's an issue of blame and placing the target of why these things are happening. And when you don't have sort of a loud enough and organized voice that says these things are happening because of neoliberalism, naming the system, or because of, you know, policies handed by the European Central Bank, and really naming who is doing that and putting people in and gathering people around that kind of focus, it does leave a vacuum where people are lost and people are desperate for an answer. And if the loudest voice is someone who comes in and says it's because immigrants are coming in and taking your jobs, or I mean, you see this all the time in Greece when people want to talk about why aren't taxes being collected? In if there's a failure of a left party to say, well, it's because there's no system to collect them, it's very easy for the far right to come in and say, well, it's because there are all these migrants who come and sell things on the street and thus don't pay a sales tax. And as absurd as that sounds, that idea had gained traction several years ago. I really do think that if there isn't an organized left alternative, it really leaves a political vacuum for the far right.
So that makes perfect sense. Now, I think that there are kind of three poles to sort of mention here of how these far right parties are manifesting, because it's not a monolithic block. And mm-hmm. I think that there are three representations here that we can go to, and they're obviously each very disturbing in their own way. And I'd like your thoughts on these three examples, and I'll give you sort of some of my assessment as well. But so in Greece, which you just mentioned, we have Golden Dawn, which they think they got about 8% of the vote in this last cycle in these European elections. And these are elections, we should say, for European Parliament. They're not national elections, to be clear about that. And there does tend to be lower turnout for these elections. But nonetheless, the trend here is really clear. Now, Golden Dawn is, I mean, they are literally a neo-Nazi party. There is really, like, no... there has been Golden Dawn members that have physically assaulted other members of parliament on television. They've actually organized groups of street thugs to harass Roma communities on the street and other migrants and immigrant communities. I mean, this is the sort of you're dumping like a 1930s, 1940s fascist party in, you know, modern Greece, modern Europe. It's stunning and disturbing in its own right. Now, in the UK, you met UKU Independence Party, they performed, they actually won. They actually beat Labour and the Tories and the Lib Dems to actually win. They're more of a, they probably have the closest analogy to Republicans, I would say, because they actually really, they don't object particularly strongly to neoliberalism, but it's this kind of, the EU's taking away our Britishness. And then I'd really like you to talk about, you know, I think the French example in some ways is the most disturbing, because the National Front did great in France. And a big part of it is that this is a party that has its roots and actually very Golden Dawn-like roots, but they've rebranded under Marine Le Pen. They've really softened certainly the anti-Semitism while escalating the Islamophobia, which is, let's be blunt, it's actually, Islamophobia is pretty popular politics in a lot of parts of the West. And they've married that with a pretty robustly economically progressive message. And they're at a point where, you know, you can't actually exclude, you cannot categorically say they won't win the next French presidential election. So anyway, I would love, you know, your thought and any other examples that you think are relevant in terms of situating these polls and the distinctions and the overlaps and what's really most dangerous coming out of these elections.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good overview. And to start with the Greek example, I mean, yes, it's absolutely right. I mean, Golden Dawn is a criminal organization at this point. Many of their leaders have been jailed because they've been legitimately tied to murders and other acts of violence. And also to add that these attacks that they conduct on immigrants are done with the full sanction of the police. It's measured that apparently 50% of members of the Greek police vote for Golden Dawn. But if you look in Greek society, what the fear about the rise of the right within their own country is, I mean, Golden Dawn is a part of it, but what they're more afraid of is what people call like the banality of racism. You can have as many street thugs on the street, you know, but where it really gets scary is if someone who, you know, looks otherwise unoffensive, doesn't have radical politics, you know, radical right-wing politics, and they say to you in the elevator, gee, there are a lot of migrants out here today, and the way they might think about the way might talk about what the weather is like is a really big temperature check on the population at large. If there is a right-wing resurgence in Greece, Golden Dawn is going to be a part of it, but it's going to come from more, I don't want to use the word moderate sectors, but not as thuggish and not as overtly kind of neo-Nazi in its image, which I think it's right to contrast that with something like the French National Front. I mean, Le Pen's father was sort of, when I was growing up, was considered this sort of global buffoon. He was this,
right.
this caricature, this person who didn't know how to speak in public, who would say anti-Semitic things,
yes.
which made him look incredibly, you know, which it made it impossible to take him seriously.
The Vichys aren't that bad. The Vichy regime wasn't that bad. Jews are annoying,
right.
You know, literally stuff like that. I mean, it was incredible. Yeah, right.
The Holocaust is but a mere detail of history. I mean,
right.
Things that made the National Front look like David Duke, pariah craziness in Europe. And what his daughter has done quite interestingly and it's quite ingenious to sort of rebrand the party as something that doesn't look like you know, your grandfather's National Front. On the first point, they have kind of quietly pushed away the anti-Semitic rhetoric. I think it's still there, but they have focused it more on Islamophobia, which there is a lot of in Europe. And what's even scary about that is that they can couch that in both terms of anti-terrorism, that, oh, well, this is really just to defend ourselves against terrorism, which is which feeds into the fear of a lot of people. But it also weirdly brings in this liberal rhetoric of, well, we're fighting for the Enlightenment, we're fighting for women's rights, we're fighting for religious freedom, and these are all liberal, European Enlightenment ideas. So it's a lot easier for them to focus on the Islamophobia stuff, whereas the anti-Semitic stuff just immediately brings back, you know, things from World War II that no one's going to accept. So she comes forward. She's very well spoken. She's very poised, and she the rhetoric is toned down enough that it can be acceptable. And I think that's absolutely correct that you point out is that what that means now, especially with this last election, is that we can't think of them as a pariah party anymore. They have to be dealt with. They're going to put demands on the table that may not be achieved because they don't have that much power, but are going to have to be addressed by social democrats and center-right parties and far-right parties. And I think that is a big advance for them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then sort of in Europe, you have the kind of, in the UK, I think UKIP, you know, again, they're not going to take over. But even in 2010, when David Cameron, who's this kind of incredibly, you know, just slippery kind of vacuous PR guy, but, you know, he felt his first move to rebrand the party was, I mean, and actually I have to just share it because this is just such a great political anecdote. David Cameron made a big show of being like a green conservative as part of his first run to lead the UK. And I remember he biked to work for a while, and it was discovered that his bike was followed by his car that carried all of his briefcases and stuff. So the biking was like literally all for show, and he was still, he still had a nice motorcade going. But, you know, but now with UK Independence Party doing so well, you're seeing an emergence of the Tories go back to some shockingly anti-immigrant tactics and imagery and reactionary rhetoric around Europe. And, you know, so all of these things have significant ripples. Before we get maybe to Syriza and some of the possible bright spots, are there any of these other parties, whether it's in Belgium or Hungary or anything, that you think is particularly worth or that are particularly worth highlighting because of where they're situated and what they represent?
Yeah, I think the Hungarian Jobbik Party is of particularly concern for a couple of reasons. One, despite the fact that they are not in power, what that means is that they are a big enough force to pull the center-right government further to the right. That even if the center-right doesn't hold neo-fascist ideas, in order to appease a significant sector of the population, they have to address that party. And what it's also done is there was a very interesting story about the new monument to the German occupation of Hungary. that is very controversial because its imagery is one of the German eagle sort of swooping down onto Hungary and sort of taking Hungary as the victim, when a lot of critics have pointed out that many people in the Hungarian government before the German occupation were eager to collaborate and hand over Jews and hand over other minorities. And what that kind of does is it's a kind of rhetoric that allows fascist parties in outside of Germany to talk about fascism and Nazism as something that someone else did, that some occupying army brought into their country, and denies that those were currents that were always there, that there were collaborators all over Europe. I mean, for France, there were collaborators, and in the Netherlands. And so it's a type of rhetoric that tries to erase the fascist currents within their own country. And so for a party like Jobbik, that allows it to kind of erase the memory, but also tap into fascist feelings that are actually there.
Yeah, I mean, how does that work? Because, you know, some of these parties, again, the ones that haven't had the rebrand, clearly, again, like Golden Dawn, obviously, they're a criminal organization, but they obviously carry these currents. Jobbik carries these currents. So how do they balance dissociating themselves historically from the same politics that they are vocally articulating and embracing? I mean, that's a kind of – how do they thread that needle?
Because I think it's often hard for us as Americans to understand European conceptions of fascism, because fascism really isn't a political ideology that exists in the United States. In the United States, people might call a very right-wing person fascist as a kind of pejorative, but it's a very particular ideology that no one would actually in America openly associate with. Right. In Europe, it is a very, very deep current, and everyone can sort of agree, well, not everyone, but most in mainstream Europe, will agree that Nazis were bad, that the Holocaust was bad, that it was real, but they could point to say, well, Mussolini was a fascist. He didn't set up concentration camps, that there are sort of this current of fascist thinking that, wouldn't say we're going to reopen concentration camps and put people on trains, but yeah, we should centralize power. We should, the state and corporate, sector should be merged, and that democracy just, is inefficient, and it's easier to have concentrated state power. But that the horror of the Holocaust was sort of some extreme, perversion of this political ideology.
So that was the aberration.
This was just fascism gone too far, that wasn't pure, fascism, that was just this crazy ideology, but that there are people who might point to the Italian regime as something that they would want to, or Franco, although the, Franco's legacy is a lot bloodier than, his apologists would like to admit.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, okay. So let's go to the potential bright spots here. So I think, again, the significant context here is that the mainstream center left in Europe has really just basically, it's in an utterly exhausted state. And it is kind of, in some respects, post crash, sadly, it's not surprising that in the economic environment Europe finds itself in, that there would be an attraction to some far-right ideologies. But I think what actually is sort of surprising in some respects is just how well the center-right has done post-crash. And that really is just a reflection that the center-left is exhausted in Europe. They're compromised by supporting austerity. As you point out, in France, when Hollande was elected, he was running not on a particularly left platform, but he was actually running as, I'm going to go to the Germans, we're going to have some type of stimulus strategy, I'm going to kind of advocate policies to actually grow the European economy. Obviously, that hasn't materialized into anything. Germany is still imposing pretty harsh austerity in Brussels. So basically, I guess there's Syriza in Greece representing, I would say, they're called far left in America. They do have some Marxists and other kind of genuine leftists, but I would say their actual policy they're advocating is just a genuine kind of Keynesian policy. And then obviously there's different movements in Europe, and there are people on the mainstream center left who would like to, you know, return to power as an example. So at least, you know, there's some of these things happening out there. I mean, I guess so. Maybe explain the success of Syriza, and, you know, are there other kind of like green shoots out there in Europe that we could look to as possible countercurrents to these really shocking results?
Yeah. Last night in Brooklyn, Jacobin Magazine actually hosted a panel with a member of Syriza and of their German counterpart, Der Linke, with the left party. So these are ideas that and these questions that are coming up a lot now. I think with Syriza, well, first of all, the issue of where they stand politically. I mean, they do call themselves the Coalition of the Radical Left. They are an amalgamation of formerly disparate radical and progressive parties. And on the question of whether or not they want to be socially democratic or go farther than that, I think they are leaning farther than that. And particularly because it was a social democratic government that brought on austerity. It was the Pan-Hellenic Socialist Movement, Papandreou's party, who signed the first memorandum of understanding with the Troika. And so what has happened to the mainstream of social democracy or social democratic parties in Greece is that they've been completely decimated. PASOK has almost no credibility at this point. Its junior partner, the Democratic Left, is on the verge of disintegration, and there are hopes that Syriza may absorb some of their cadres. So the assumption is that if mainstream social democracy got us into this mess, if we come to power, we have to present something more radical, something that is going to put more demands on the Troika for either to manage our own affairs or to ease the debt, things like that. And I think that is very popular among Greeks, not just because of the results that we've just seen, but because of how fast their ascendance has happened. 2 years ago, they were coming up, but still far from victory. And a lot of that had to do with much of the union base and in the working class still having its ties to the Social Democratic parties, particularly PASOK. And I think that's melting away. And what you'll also see is you have a big kind of anarchist contingent in Greece who would say, well, we don't back any government, we don't back any political party, and they may say that in their rhetoric, but a lot of them would say, don't tell anyone, but I'm voting for Syriza. In part, well, I think there's two reasons. One, they do see some hope in Syriza for getting them out of the mess that they're in, but also that the fear of what the far right has to offer is so catastrophic that it could push a lot of anarchists into the political arena where they wouldn't normally go.
Right, because of just the raw danger of the Golden Dawn and everything associated with that, and the more kind of softer iterations you're talking about. So I guess in Greece it's very clear. Syriza's obviously having this moment, and it's very important, and in some respects obviously reflective of the fact that Greece has, through the austerity measures imposed on it and through the fact that, as you alluded to earlier, another significant part of why Greece is in the mess it's in, again, it's another one of these examples where the mainstream narrative is that it's the social safety net. It's not, and, you know, lack of work ethic. So no, it's not. And actually Greeks work, you know, according to sort of raw hours, harder than Germans. So that whole kind of stereotype is sort of flipped around. But, you know, lack of tax collection, systemic corruption, and crony capitalism. And, you know, yes, dysfunctional crony government bureaucracy, certainly. But that is not, you know, that's not an indictment of having a serious, robust social safety net and social welfare systems. But so Greece is obviously at the harshest effect of these policies in many respects, because they've just been utterly decimated. I mean, they've been basically forced into a depression over the last several years. But do you see these shoots elsewhere, or is this very much a Greece and Syriza phenomenon? And, you know, in the rest of Europe, it's going to kind of slag along.
Well, my hope. Well, I think Greece is very much the the most dramatic example, just because of the results we saw the other day.
Right.
But the BBC had an overview of where else similar parties were, perhaps not dramatically rising, but rising nonetheless. And I mean, it was for the most part the list of the Mediterranean countries who are dealing with the debt crisis with the Troika: Spain, Portugal, to a smaller extent, Italy. So. That is, I mean, it's sort of fairly reasonable explanation that is in the countries where there is so much anger at their own political establishment and the European political establishment, that's where those political formations are going to arise. And if you look, you know, even in places where the far right has won, in, you know, England or in the UK or in France, the established left is sort of so hoary and so tied to kind of Cold War politics, groups like the French Communist Party or the British Socialist Workers Party, that it's kind of impossible to see them as resuscitated into some kind of force that could stop the UK Independence Party.
Right, because they're just exhausted and anachronistic.
They're exhausted and anachronistic, and creating a new ideology within those formations would be turning, you know, it's like turning around the Titanic.
Right.
And so to create new political formations really are going to have to come from the bottom, both in the economic but in geographical sense. I think they're going to come from places like Greece and Spain and Italy, where the suffering politically and economically is the worst.
Absolutely. Well, Ari Paul, independent political journalist, friend, sometime writing partner, thank you so much for joining us today. And that was very enlightening and very disturbing, with a couple of potential sources of hope. So look, we took you through a broad emotional palette there.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure. All right. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Talk to you.
All right, folks. What do we say? I think we might want to take you to that fun half pretty soon.
Yes, we do. Yeah. It's truly disturbing, though, how, like, I mean, I guess it makes sense. Those who have those feelings are usually going to be the loudest. And that's usually the problem with our politics here, when we talk about, you know, why isn't the left louder? Why don't they?
Right.
Why aren't they? But I guess when you have hatred seeping through you, it's just more powerful to go out there and be forced to fight for that hatred than it is to just, I mean, I don't even know how to put it in words, but I hear what you're saying.
I mean, it's really disturbing. And, you know, it is an important distinction, because I do, like, we obviously have far right populism in America, which is it's a serious danger in a number of different ways. Fascism as a more kind of precise term and sense of politics, you know, it's like in America, almost everybody, maybe, you know, I don't know, probably there's a handful of people online, but if you told Clive and Bundy's people, hey, you're fascist, they would be so offended, right? And they're not. I mean, they're extremists, they're far right, they're everything. But there's a lot of people, you know, not a lot, but there's a chunk of people you'd say, hey, in Europe, you'd be like, you're a fascist. And they'd be like, yeah, yes, that's my politics. That's right. So, you know, it's definitely a different, there's a different context for it. And I also think that, you know, the real danger is, I do think, particularly in France, because as Ari was saying, I mean, this woman has really, without in any substantive way really changed the party, she's basically created this really PR savvy engine that encompasses all of the grievances of most French people, like their racism, their Islamophobia that's very widespread and really hugely problematic, which is being exploited, along with, like, we got to protect our social safety net and our healthcare. And, you know, you look at some of these, like, there's this group that actually didn't do well in Britain, but, you know, because they're very, but like the British National Party, they'll say, like, look, the reason we don't want immigrants because we don't want them using the NHS, right? I mean, so, like, their argument's not with the NHS, it's having somebody who lives, you know, there and doesn't look like them. So anyways, it's very disturbing. We're going to try to get on the phones today. Hopefully they will be working. Obviously, I'm going to open up, fire up the IMs in a second.
And while we do that, we're going to make the call now for all of you freeloaders out there.
Come on, guys.
Become a member today at majority.fm. It's less than a cup of coffee a day. You know what? It's probably less than half a cup of that cup of coffee. I mean, come on.
If you have, like, we get that there are people who, like, don't have a dollar in their pocket, which is why we give memberships to folks who need it. And that's great. That's
oh, yeah, this isn't, this isn't, that we're is not talking
the,
to you guys.
That's one of the proudest, actually, we're genuinely, talking, that's one of the things that makes me most proud of working on this program.
Yes.
But
we're talking
if,
to
we're
the,
talking if you
to
do.
The people who are too yeah. lazy to pull out that credit card, type in their details into PayPal,
yes.
and send us that, what is it, 30 some, less than 30 cents a day.
I think it's a little above 30. But the point is that every day, not just your cup of coffee. I mean, it's like, look, if you have even just a little bit of money, you've already spent more than a membership by the time you're hitting lunch. And look what you get. I mean, very least.
What would happen if one day you went to hit that lunch? You went on your lunch break and you pulled out your phone or your laptop or whatever, and you tune in to majority.fm. And all you got was a blank page because we no longer existed. Because
we were gone. And all of a sudden that banter and that deep incisive policy insight and that right-wing Mandela impression was gone. And it was just your stale tuna sandwich all alone. You would hate that.
You would.
Just become a member.
You would.
Also, people feel great after they become a member. So go to majorityreport.com/become a member. It take you a second. And honestly, if you don't want to deal with PayPal, whatever, that's your thing.
Email
us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We'll give you a mailing address. Snail mail us a check. Boom, you're done. A lot of people do that too. No problem. So do it. Download the app if you haven't already.
At majorityapp.com. And then going with how you also can support the show monetary-wise, go to majorityreportkickback.com. That'll lead you straight to our Amazon affiliate link. And you will notice no difference. It's the Amazon homepage. You just use that link. Amazon sees that you're coming to them through us. And whenever you buy something through there, they give us a teeny tiny kickback. But when enough teeny tiny kickbacks add up, it's just a tiny kickback. And even a tiny kickback helps out around here.
Tiny kickback helps out around here. Follow, like us on Facebook. We post a lot of fun stuff on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Go to our YouTube page at YouTube/Sam Cedar. So many different fun ways of interacting with the show and sharing with your friends. You don't want to, you know, don't be unfair to them. Like, I know that after you listen to that interview, you're going to be able, if you're out having beers with your buddies and someone brings up what happened in Europe, you're going to be able to polish, like, you heard Ari talk. You're going to be able to break it down. Don't be selfish with that. Let your friends look, on top of their games too by listening to the Majority Report.
We know a lot of you actually to take credit for what you hear on the show.
Yeah, we know
you're
that.
You're at the bar, someone's saying something incredibly stupid,
and
you chime in with something you heard on this show, and then all of a sudden everyone in the bar thinks you are the smartest person within a 5-block radius.
Everyone's like, that's the Lift the Cap guy. Don't mess with him. All right, folks, we'll see you in the fun half of the show. I'll be right back.
And to the person who complained about the English version of La Poupée, just for you, we'll go back to the classic for today. Here you are.